heart and home.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but please do not call unless we specifically request the calls, because right now we have on the line Dr. Jerome Corsi, who writes for the WorldNet Daily and has done a wonderful job writing on the immigration issue, and more recently on the Security and Prosperity Program Partnership, which is simply a veiled effort, and of course a secret effort in many respects, to do away with American sovereignty and merge the United States with Mexico and Canada into a North American Union. And despite the insistence of our leaders that this is not their intent, it's exactly what's going on. Dr. Corsi, thanks so much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, always a great honor to be with you.
Well, what are the latest issues that you'd like to cover tonight?
Well, we can start with some of the recent stories I've been writing in WorldNet Daily. I've been trying to support the book, The Late Great USA, Coming Merger with Mexico and Canada. And I was up in Montebello, Quebec, during the SPP third summit meeting, when President Bush joined Felipe Calderon, the President of Mexico, who flew up to Quebec, and Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada. The three of them held this two-day summit meeting. It was actually a very short summit meeting. It didn't even really, it was over 2 days, but it didn't even really last 24 hours. And it struck me as the most awkward of the summit meetings. When Vincente Fox was in the mix with George Bush, it was a very different chemistry. These three leaders seemed very awkward together. And I had press credentials with WorldNet Daily, so I was in the compound, actually, at the press conference the final day. And the press had been kept out, Dr. Sandler, this entire meeting. I mean, that was dominated by the North American Competitiveness Council, which is this group that very few people know anything about. It's a group of 30 corporations that are picked by the chambers of commerce in three countries. It's a business agenda that dominates the Security and Prosperity Partnership. And these multinational corporations met behind closed doors with the leaders and with the working group bureaucrats, and they, in closed door sessions, worked to eliminate regulations and create the beginnings of a North American common market, which is their goal, and no press was allowed into it. The press section, you know, the press was over there playing video poker on their laptop computers. It was hardly anything to do except watch the news feeds that were being brought into the press area. Hundreds of thousands of dollars spent for this meeting, and it was a totally secret, closed-door agenda.
Well, then, really, why would they even allow the press in? They're not going to let them find out what's going on.
Well, they cover the press, the photo ops, and write the stories that they're fed the feed to write.
But, of course, if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it? Why are they holding secret meetings, you know, to conceal the truth from the American people? And, of course, I think they know that the average American, the average Canadian, the average Mexican doesn't want to give up their sovereignty. They want their countries, but it is the elitists who have a different agenda. And, of course, they want to do away with sovereignty, to do away with freedom, and bring everybody under their benevolent control. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Jerome Corsi. Will you pick this story up there?
Well, Dr. Stanwood, these 30 corporations, they include corporations that are very close to the Bush administration or part of the Security and Prosperity Partnership, like Lockheed Martin, the defense company that is working with Hutchison Ports Holding, the communist Chinese ports firm. Hutchison Whampoa, the holding company at the top, they manage these ports down in Lazaro Cardenas and Manzanilla, the Mexican ports south of Texas. And Hutchison Whampoa is putting all along I-35, they're putting in sensors in a joint venture with Hutchison Whampoa to monitor the millions and millions of Chinese containers they expect to be coming up Interstate 35 as we lose our manufacturing to China, and containers with the manufactured cheap goods, slave goods from China come into North America. So they're one of the 30 companies. And Kansas City Southern Railroads, they're another one of the 30 companies. They're the NAFTA railroads. General Electric, General Motors, international companies, FedEx International, Walmart, of course, and then equal companies from Canada and Mexico. And the experience, Dr. Stan, of being at this meeting, and, you know, the knowing that the leaders were there, the leaders kind of flew in for only press opportunities. They were with the working groups for very short periods of time, and all of the agreements that came out of this meeting were pretty much predetermined by the bureaucrats working, again, in closed sessions, unreported to the press. The whole thing is a closed secret agenda. That was the overwhelming impression I got being there. And then at the press conference, I was sitting about two rows behind the Fox reporter who asked the three leaders if the Security and Prosperity Partnership was going to lead to a North American Union or to NAFTA superhighways. And George Bush started off the answering, and of course what he did, Dr. Stan, was he did not answer the question. It was a opportunity for George Bush to say outright, Security and Prosperity Partnership is not headed towards the North American Union and is not going to build NAFTA superhighways. But that's not what George Bush did. He ridiculed the idea. He said it's a conspiracy theory, and anybody who would believe in this has to be trying to scare the American people. Well, next time I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, you know, the ridicule is the last refuge of a scoundrel in a debate who's lost the argument. They can't answer the argument with evidence or reason. They have to try to discredit the other person so nobody listens to them. The history of presidential denials...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Jerome Corsi. And Dr. Corsi attended a meeting in Canada here in the last week or so, where the heads of the United States, George Bush, and the president of both the president of Mexico, the new president, and then the premier of Canada met together. But apparently there were about 30 major corporations, private corporations that are all behind this. When they had a press conference, somebody from Fox Network asked the President Bush if this was really an effort to build a North American Union, and of course this massive highway, the NASCOM highway, or this Trans-American highway, the NAFTA highway. And instead of addressing the question, President Bush began to ridicule the people who thought that there was an effort to do away with our sovereignty and build a North American Union. And he effectively demonized them, accused them of believing in a conspiracy. Well, the trouble is that there is a conspiracy. We can see it having unfolded in Europe. We can see it unfolding throughout the world. And remember, of course, this is the same President Bush who told us about that he was going to get Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. He promised the American people that. And then, of course, he didn't try to get him. This is the same president who insisted that, of course, there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that threatened us, and that's why we had to go to war with Iraq. And now, of course, she ridicules and demonizes people who suggest that he is involved in a program to do away with our sovereignty. And yet, of course, he tells us we're involved in a war on terrorism, and yet he steadfastly refuses to close our southern border or protect us from terrorists coming across the southern border. He, of course, had signed the legislation that was going to require the building of a 700 or 800 mile fence, and that is effectively blocked building a fence to protect our southern border. And then he attacks people who suggested that he's not that he's going to merge the United States with Mexico. Well, pick up the story there, Dr. Corsi.
Well, Dr. Sanders, I was sitting there at the press conference at Montebello at this Security and Prosperity Partnership meeting, and when President Bush was asked about the Security and Prosperity Partnership, all three leaders were asked, and they chose to ridicule the idea that there was a North American Union or NAFTA superhighways. The first thing I'm thinking is that, you know, this is not answering the question. The history of presidential denials, by the time a question is asked to a president at an international news conference, it's gained a great deal of credibility in the grassroots. So I'm remembering when Richard Nixon at a press conference during Watergate said, "I am not a crook," and his administration had portrayed Watergate as a third-rate burglary. Well, that ended up in costing Richard Nixon his job. He had to resign. And then Bill Clinton saying, "I did not have sex with that woman." Again, another presidential denial. Now trying to, again, dismiss anyone who would raise the issue. Well, he was impeached over that issue, over lying under oath on that question. So these presidential denials, when they occur, the first thought I had was, well, we're back again in these, you know, twilight zones, where the president has been caught doing something he doesn't want to admit, so he's just going to ridicule or lie.
I remember Bill Clinton saying, you know, it already depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
Right. And by the time they game semantics, they've lost. And then Harper, Prime Minister of Canada, says, well, you know, there's no NAFTA superhighways, and we're also not going to build them interplanetary, you know, a big joke. And he said that, trying to dismiss the importance of these meetings by saying there was one of the business leaders in the North American Competitiveness Council who manufactures jelly beans. And there's two standards for jelly beans, one in the contents, one in Canada, the other in the United States. So they were trying, Harper said, well, if we standardize the content requirements for jelly beans across North America, I don't think we're costing Canada its sovereignty. And I'm saying to myself, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars spent to have this meeting, and Harper's trying to convince the world all they're talking about is jelly bean standardization, saying, you know, this is so pathetically ridiculous that either Harper is lying, which is obvious that he is, or, you know, he's trying to play people for fools, thinking that that's all they would actually be talking about in these secret meetings. And also then, Felipe Calderon came on and ridiculed it. He said there's a lot of, you know, comic theories that are ridiculous about what they're achieving. And I'm saying to myself, look, all they have to do is make these meetings open to the public, put them on C-SPAN, let the public participate, and they don't have to answer these questions about what their secret agenda is, but they won't do that. They want the secret meetings. And they wanted this press conference just to be a celebration of the security and prosperity coming out and telling us that this is all good for us without getting into any of the details of what they're doing. When they get into the details of what they're doing, we find out when they publish on the website, spp.gov, one of the agreements they came up with was a North American plan for avian flu and pandemic influenza. And the plan ends up being a agreement by the three leaders that they're going to submit to UN control in the case of an international health emergency. And I'm researching this and writing about it on WorldNet Daily. I'm saying, okay, there's a health czar, you know, flu czar appointed by the UN. His name is David Nabarro, N-A-B-A-R-R-O. He's a UK physician who's had third world experience. And for the past 2 years, the Barrow has been trying to scare everybody into the inevitability of a health epidemic that would kill between 5 and 150 million people. You say, well, you know, is it going to be 5 or 150 million? His answer is, well, if you give the UN more power, it'll be more likely only 5 million. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a classic. You know, create a huge scare and grab power at an international level. And this is a lot more serious than jelly beans.
And, of course, you know, the incredible thing about this whole thing is that actually they've sent scientists up to both Alaska and into Norway and Finland, you know, to dig up the victims of the 1918 flu so they could get the virus, so they could experiment on the virus to find out why it was so deadly and why it could be spread so rapidly. Why would you do something like that unless you were trying to create a deadly virus that could be spread throughout the world? And then, of course, you know, if you did have an epidemic, you could justify worldwide, or at least North American-wide, if this epidemic was here, martial law. In fact, we know that the president actually has passed presidential directives, 51 and 21, I think they are, Homeland Security and National Security, on the 9th of May of this year, as you well know, that allows him to establish a dictatorship in America without congressional committee permission for an indefinite period of time if there's an epidemic or some other crisis. And why in the entire history of our nation would at this time in history the President of the United States put forward presidential directives which are certainly not approved of by our Congress that allows him to have the ability to declare a dictatorship in America? And where is the outcry from both the media and our other political leaders?
Well, that's right. I wrote about that. And part of what I'm saying in the late, great USA is that we have a globalist power grab going on. And George Bush is right at the center of it. He's their chief agent, just like his father, with the New World Order. And Bill Clinton. I mean, the whole Clinton-Bush dynasty, which seems to be forming, is a move towards globalism. And I write about the National Security Presidential Directive 51 and Homeland Security Presidential Directive 20, because they do allow the president to declare an emergency and then to say he's in charge of all levels of government, federal, state, local, territorial, and tribal, without even necessarily going to Congress to allow Congress to limit or otherwise change this declaration. Now, President Bush has done several things in this regard. He's also, there's a contract out, and I validated this, with KBR. They're a subsidiary, former subsidiary of Halliburton. They were paid $385 million to be ready to create detention centers on a contingency basis at the direction of the Department of Homeland Security. So when the Department of Homeland Security says we need a detention facility here, and who knows what the emergency will be. It could be an emergency, another Katrina. It could be a natural disaster of any kind, a hurricane, a health epidemic, a terrorist event, like 9/11. What about if the event were simply a civil insurrection or a domestic riot like we had in the 60s? You could still have detention centers being built. And then I interviewed NORAD, because we've created in NORTHCOM a U.S. continental command to use the U.S. military in domestic emergency situations. It's a brand new definition of U.S. NORTHCOM. And I found a little notice regulation that permits the Army to create civilian labor camps on U.S. Army bases.
And that's really been around for a couple of years now. You can actually get Dr. Corsi's article and actually link to that and pull it down. It's exactly as he said. In fact, this subsidiary of Halliburton gets $385 million a year to stand by for 4 years, 4-year extension on that If you'd like to see the article out of the paper, we have it clipped, or go to worldnetdaily.com and pull down Dr. Corsi's newsletters. Why would they, at this time in history, what are they planning? And they're not giving Halliburton all that money for nothing, are they? Go right ahead.
Well, listen, this whole idea of creating army prison labor camps, I was astounded. The Army regulations.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iOtterol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency, and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Halliburton to be prepared to build concentration camps, the John Warner legislation, the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act, which was passed last October, does away with the restrictions on posse comitatus. In other words, now the president can use the military against the American people, the National Guard against the American people. This was illegal before that. Why are they suddenly making all these changes in our laws that would allow the president to declare a dictatorship and put people into concentration camps? And people say that's just imaginary. And yet now we understand that at these meetings, they're holding as they plan to merge all of North America into a North American Union, the so-called Security and Prosperity Partnership. They're talking about turning over control of our health issues in cases of emergency to the United Nations. Well, when you understand that the real goal behind everything is a world government under the United Nations, that everything is in place for a world government, the world army, which is NATO, the world police force, which is Interpol, the world court, certainly the legislature, which is the General Assembly, the executive, which is the secretariat, and that we have everything is in place for world government. That's the ultimate goal. It's always been the ultimate goal. And with that comes the end of national sovereignty for America and the end of the freedom which we've enjoyed so well. And it's almost as if there's some sort of a gigantic plan as everything is coming together. Do you get that feeling, Dr. Corsi?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, for the book, The Late Great USA, I interviewed Robert Pastor, Dr. Sand. He is a professor at American University. He's been writing for 10 years to create a North American community. When he was with in the administration of Jimmy Carter, Pastor was on the National Security Council, and he engineered giving the Panama Canal to Panama. On page 30 of the book, I begin a section in which I interviewed Dr. Pastor, and Dr. Pastor had written an article, he'd given an interview in Spanish, which I'd read, a Spanish language magazine that had published this interview. And Pastor said that the next 9/11 may be all that would be needed to create, you know, a North American community under this North American, it gets back on the path of North American integration. And that was particularly frightening when I realized that we have all this emergency structure in place under President Bush. A pastor said to me, and I quote this on page 32 of the book, that, you know, it's not that I want another 9/11 crisis, but if we have one, it may force decisions on North American integration that otherwise may not be made. So there you are with the full outlay of the plan that we have a crisis, an emergency, the next 9/11, and this time we're not caught by surprise. We've got all this apparatus in place to create a continental emergency and to utilize these detention facilities, the militarize, the National Guard, declare martial law, put the U.S. military into domestic duty throughout the continent, and in the process, tell the American people the only way we can secure your prosperity and, you know, security and prosperity, that's what this is all about. It's almost like George Orwell, the Security and Prosperity Partnership. The only way we can get this for you is if we take command.
And, of course, we sent our boys overseas to Afghanistan and Iraq to fight for freedom while we are losing our freedom here at home. What a wonderful diversion it is. And our attention is focused on the Middle East, where, of course, there is a plan to remove our freedom here. And I think that Charles Lindbergh said it best during the Second World War. When we send our boys overseas to fight for democracy, we will lose our freedom here. It's exactly what happened during Vietnam. I mean, we, of course, never tried to win in Vietnam, but it was a wonderful diversion because a great social revolution took place during that time as they began to bring in the Medicare, socialized medicine, and Medicaid, and the welfare state, and of course, they massively increased the government control over every aspect of our lives, the war on cancer, the war on drugs, the war on poverty. We began moving towards a socialist society during the Vietnam War. And that's exactly what Big George Bundy, who was the architect of that, said in Foreign Affairs magazine in January of 1967. But most people never read that, nor do they understand the significance of who Big George Bundy was or what he represents. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Jerome Corsi. Go right ahead with this story. And certainly it sounds like what we're seeing now is like Vietnam all over again. Our attention is focused overseas, whereas, of course, they're taking away our freedom here. And everything is in place, really, for the a military dictatorship right here in America. And all we need is another crisis, and I'm sure they can manufacture one without much problem at all.
Well, and Dr. Stan, I also point out in the book that, you know, I read a whole chapter of the late great USA, that chapter one, and how the North American Union will be formed. And I look back to the European Union and show that it was a stealth process, a stealth methodology. Jean Monnet, the French intellectual who knew he wanted to eliminate Germany's sovereignty because he felt that Germany had caused two world wars and he didn't want it to happen again. The French had lost the wars without the United States and he didn't like that. And the multinational corporations that wanted no regulations because they wanted, under fascism, to have the corporations be the rulers and the state just served the corporate needs. Well, the idea in the European Union was to create a fait accompli before the people could vote. So when the votes occurred, there was no choice but to ratify the reality that was already put in place. And I wrote a lot in the book, and I've been writing lately. I was saying, George Bush, we're 6 years into a war on terror, and our borders with Mexico and Canada are wide open. And that the Security and Prosperity Partnership, which was declared in Waco, Texas on March 23, 2005 with Vincente Fox, with Canada's Prime Minister Paul Martin. That was an agreement for these working groups to, you know, behind the scenes, out of, you know, below the radar, behind closed doors, no one could see what they were doing, to open the borders. So now we have, the administration admits, 12 million illegal aliens in the United States. The number is probably 20 or 30 million. But the government admits to 12 million illegal aliens. And with 895 or 900,000 of them a year coming in during the Bush administration, you know, that means 600,000. That means basically, let's just take a million a year. That means 6 million, half or more of that 12 million have come in while George Bush has been president. You know, roughly, that's the number. And then George Bush says, this problem which I've allowed to continue to happen, well, I can't solve. We've got one-tenth of Mexico's population living in the United States by the government's own numbers.
Hold that thought, Dr. Corsi, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Corsi is saying that we have about, one-sixth of the Mexico's population?
One-tenth. One-tenth.
10% of Mexico's population is living in the United States at the present time. And certainly almost half of those have come in under the Bush administration, which, despite the fact that the president insists we're involved in war and terrorism, and we've got to give up our freedom to fight those wicked terrorists so that they don't take away our freedom, the president refuses steadfastly to try to seal our border. And we have to ask how serious they really are in their desire to fight terrorism, or is this simply a mirage to get us justified to be willing to give up our freedom? So pick up the story there, please.
Well, Dr. Stan, I wrote the book, Late Great USA, to open people's minds and to show them how this process was going and to give you 30 pages of footnotes, almost every one of which is to a government website, so you could go see that every claim I'm making in the book is backed up by a government document. There is authoritative references here which you can see with your own eyes on the Internet.
Well, I think it's an excellent book. Incidentally, we are carrying the book, The Late Great USA, Well, Dr. Corsi, do you have a website or any other information you'd like to get out for our listeners?
I'm writing almost every day on worldnetdaily.com. I'm a staff reporter, and you can see the work there on WorldNet Daily, and the book is a WorldNet Daily book.
Right, and it's an excellent book, really very well done.
Well, thank you. And I'm showing now, let's say we go to 2010, we project forward, we're going to have one out of every five people born in Mexico living in the United States under the Mexican flag, as a Mexican national citizen, with today some 47 Mexican consular offices to protect their civil rights as Mexican nationals living in our country, demanding the prosecution of Border Patrol agents like Ramos Campion, who shot after fleeing Mexican drug smuggler, and the Border Patrol agents are in federal prison for 11 and 12 years each, because Mexico demanded it. And I raise the question that this is the incrementalism. We are already, under the Security and Prosperity Partnership, a dual nation. And when President Bush addresses this issue, he handles it just like the European bureaucrats pushing the European Union agenda did. President Bush comes to the Senate and he says, there's nothing I can do about this. I can't solve this problem, by the way, that I created. And so President Bush asks the Senate to pass a law, the Kennedy-McCain-Shamnesty Bill, I call it, that essentially would legitimate the right of these illegal aliens to stay in the country. It would, bless the de facto reality, fait accompli, that President Bush has intentionally created by leaving the borders open. Tomorrow, we're going to see the Mexican trucks come across the border. This Department of Transportation Mexican Truck Demonstration Project. 100 Mexican trucking companies allowing their long-haul rigs to run anywhere they want in the United States. And I'm saying there's going to be thousands of trucks that are part of these 100 companies coming into the United States. And, of course, it's in complete, again, disregard of the will of the people. The House voted 411-3, a Safe Roads Act of 2007 that would have blocked this Mexican truck demonstration from starting. But the Federal Motor Carriers Safety Administration finessed it by a regulatory ploy that's almost too complex to explain.
No, I think what we really have to understand is the executive branch of government does not care what our elected representatives want, does not care what the American people want, is above any of the laws of our land. We have a ruling elite who have their own agenda. And that agenda is to destroy the sovereignty of the United States and step by step to merge us with Mexico and Canada into this wonderful new North American Union. And if anybody doubts that there is a plan for this, we have a video. It's called American Union 2005. It was filmed many years ago where David Rockefeller is addressing this group about the glories of this coming American Union, which he anticipated and predicted would be here by 2005. Fortunately, he was wrong. It's been put off a little longer, but that's the objective. And so when the president and all of these other people say, well, we don't want a North American Union, they are simply, frankly, not telling the truth. And that video or DVD, our video is available from Radio Liberty. It's called American Union 2005, where Dr. David Rockefeller talks and lays the whole thing out. Half an hour of David Rockefeller, certainly the most powerful and influential man in the United States, talking and explaining exactly what lies ahead. So why would the president not be forthright for the American people? You go right ahead with Dr. Corsi.
Well, Dr. Stan, the entire desire of the Bush administration is to lie. There was a press conference today in the House Transportation Committee where Peter DeFazio, who is a congressman, Democratic congressman from Oregon, who heads the subcommittee that the motor carriers are regulated under. And Peter DeFazio said very clearly today that Bush is hell-bent, those were his words, on getting the Mexican trucks in the United States, serving the needs of the multinational corporations and disregarding the will of Congress and the safety of the American people. Peter DeFazio was furious today. and he called it a stealth methodology. He accused the Bush administration of intentionally lying to the American people and not being forthright even with information as to when this demonstration project was going to start. Peter DeFazio had to pry that out of the Bush administration. They were going to send 100 trucks across the border, like in the middle of the night when nobody would know. And the underlying plan here, Dr. Stan, is to create a North American union as an economic union and a political union driven by the multinational corporations that want no regulations. They want a common currency like the Amero, where they can have no currency risk. They want North America as their base. And then they want to plug into world trade. And in world trade, the goal is to go after China for slave labor. When China, you know, I mean, it's disgraceful. We fought a civil war. At the end of the civil war, we decided that it was immoral to use African Americans as slaves in southern agricultural businesses. Now we're wink-wink for the cost of low-cost TVs and sneakers at Walmart and Kmart and all the other marts. We're allowing the slaves in communist China to be exploited by our multinational corporations. It's disgraceful, and we're morally culpable in permitting it. And so now the multinational corporations figure this is the plan where they'll get their cost of labor down to zero. And by the way, their economist, Alan Blinder, at Princeton, top economist who advised Bill Clinton to get NAFTA passed, has said in the Wall Street Journal this past March that we will lose 40 million jobs in the next two decades to outsourcing under this globalist plan, 40 million. Jobs. That's more than the number of manufacturing jobs we have right now in the entire country. So anticipates losing computer science and other jobs, including to India. So now the cost of labor is down to zero. The goal of the multinational corporations is to get the cost of transporting their containers with the slave goods back into North America down to zero, disregarding that we are running these horrible balance of trade deficits in China. China now has $1.3 trillion in foreign exchange reserves, 80% of which is held in dollar assets, with no sign of abating. We'll be at $2 trillion before we know it. China will be mortgaged to China. China will be able to destroy the United States financially just by selling dollars on the world market. They'll reduce our currency to worthless. They want to do. They've already threatened to do that. So now the goal is to reduce the cost of transportation of these containers to zero, and that's where the NAFTA superhighways come in. Because our highways, like Interstate 35, which has been called the NAFTA superhighway since NAFTA was passed in 1994, when effective, our transportation infrastructure will not handle all the trucks with all these containers. And Los Angeles and Long Beach are too expensive because they use longshoremen who are union. So the goal of communist China, put billions of dollars into these ports like Lazaro Cardenas and Manzanilla, which communist Chinese also manage through Hutchison Whampoa, a Chinese communist port management firm, international firm with close ties to the communist Chinese military and the Chinese communists who run the government. They're deepening these ports so that these huge container ships can come in and unload with Mexican dock workers. Then the transportation economists have created this concept of intermodal, which means that the container, without being reloaded, can be taken from the ship and put on a different mode of transportation, which is a Mexican truck or Mexican train, again cheap, and brought up into the heart of the United States along Interstate 35 and the new NAFTA superhighway, this Trans-Texas Corridor, 4 football fields wide, which is going to be built in Texas, financed by Spain, Cintra, C-I-N-T-R-A, a Spanish investment consortium, which will own for 5 decades the leasing rights on that highway. And cities like San Antonio, Denver, Kansas City are declaring themselves inland port. They've gone container happy. I mean, I've lived in Denver. The port is not on the Platte River. I've been in San Antonio multiple times on the Riverwalk, You know, that river walk is not the water they're talking about to be an inland port in San Antonio. It's these Mexican ports. Lazaro Cardenas and Manzanilla. And San Antonio's got Union Pacific. They're going to build a $90 million container warehouse near I-35. So these intermodal containers can be offloaded, put on trucks and trains, and brought to their final destination. We're going to become a Chinese container moving society. And the United States will lose its middle class as the jobs go to China and get re-imported in containers that China probably doesn't even want back.
I don't think really what's so incredible is that our leaders know exactly what they're doing. Their plan is to simply lower the living standards of the American people, to wipe out the middle class, and we will have a very wealthy class. We will have a massive military here in the United States, and a massive police force, and massive surveillance, and then a massive poor people in this new feudal society which is being introduced. And of course, if you doubt that, all you have to do is read the Earth Charter, which is the new Ten Commandments for America, written by three people of fabulous wealth: Gorbachev, the former dictator of Russia, Marie Strong, a multi-billionaire, Stephen Rockefeller, one of the heirs of the Rockefeller, of multi-billions or trillions of dollars. And the Earth Charter lays it all out. Equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations. How do you get equitable distribution of wealth between nations? Why, you transfer America's wealth to all the other nations in the world. And with that, of course, the future, the hope, the aspirations of our people. They know what they're doing, and anybody, of course, who points out that you can go up on the Internet and pull down the Earth Charter, which is kept in the Ark of Hope, a Luciferian counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant, because there's a strong spiritual force behind this. Why, of course, anybody who talks about this, why you think there's a conspiracy? No, I don't think there's a conspiracy. I know there's a conspiracy, and you will too if you go up on the Internet and pull down the Earth Charter and understand they're advocating a new spirituality. Go right ahead, Dr. Corse.
Well, that's it. I mean, I'm going to be attending later this month a conference in New York City, and a conference is going to be a two-day conference at the Waldorf Astoria, and it's going to be held, probably 300 government officials, state officials, investment bankers, financiers attending, and they're going to be discussing PPPs, public-private partnerships. And this is how we sell our highway infrastructure to the next generation, to foreign investment consortium, just like the Trans-Texas Corridor. Convert it all into a next generation of container movement systems. You know, lanes for trucks, lanes for train, all built at the expense of this investment consortium, which will own the leasing rights. The next generation of our highways in the United States will be toll roads, not freeways, toll roads, owned by foreign investment interests, in serving the goals of the multinational corporations, with the expectation that the average American family is going to be spending between $2,000 to $5,000 a year paying tolls, riding roads that today we ride on free.
In fact, right now, of course, they're selling off the infrastructure of our country because many of the states are so far in debt, and New Jersey sold their turnpike. Ohio sold their turnpike. Chicago's sold their skyway. And they plan to put toll roads in all over America. And, of course, they've stolen all the money, or most of the money, out of the highway trust fund to use on perks for our legislators, so they'll be fat and happy, and they won't object to what's going on. And, of course, our whole infrastructure of our society is beginning to crumble from within. And what's the solution? Well, we're just going to raise the gasoline tax again so we can steal more of the money from the trust funds. Go right ahead, Dr. Corson.
Well, the presidential candidates have been writing about this on both parties. You know, Rudy Giuliani's law firm in Texas, Bracewell and Giuliani in Houston, they're the representatives of CINTRA, C-I-N-T-R-A, the Spanish Investment Consortium, Giuliani got Sintra the deal to finance and own the leasing rights of the Trans-Texas Corridor.
Now, of course, they're using the right of eminent domain to take away the people's property,
absolutely,
to give it to a country that, a company that certainly works with Giuliani. That's not nice.
And pay nothing for the land that's stolen. Also, the Sintra, under Giuliani's direction and legal advice, is now managing the Chicago Skyway and the Indiana Toll Road. Fred Thompson, now declared as a presidential candidate, is a Council on Foreign Relations member, a globalist, who voted to expand migrant worker programs when he was in the Senate. He's a Beltway guy, whose law firm, after he got out of the Senate, represented the multinational firms that want to create this new North American Union world order.
And what's really so incredible is all of the evidence is there. Go to WorldNet Daily and pull down Dr. Gracie's articles. Pull them all down. Put them into folders. Read them, reread them. Try to get people to listen. Try to get people to understand. The enemy is not in Pakistan. The enemy is not in Afghanistan or in Iraq. That's a diversion. The enemy is right here. And the goal, of course, is the demise of America. Osama isn't going to take away our freedom. It's going to be taken away by the globalists who hate America, who hate you and your children. Well, Dr. Corsi, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I wanted to also say that we've got an article on WorldNet Daily with Hillary Clinton. And when Walter Cronkite, 1999, these are videos that are archived on the Internet. Cronkite was given an award by the World Federalist Association, and he made a speech that is preserved on video saying that the United States ought to be subjected to a one-world government. He's very clear about that. And Hillary Clinton comes on from the White House in 1999 as First Lady and says Walter Cronkite is telling us the way it could be. So she's endorsing his view. I wrote work. Lake Great USA, Dr. Sand, and gave people the documentation. Because everything we're saying tonight about the North American Union, about these globalist plans, is fully documented, largely on government websites. And I wanted to arm people with the ability to go see these videos, look at the government websites themselves with their own eyes. Because that's the only way people can begin to open their minds and get beyond the lies. What's at stake here is if we do not rise up at the grassroots level and get this information and say no, and get our congressmen, especially the congressmen, who have to be reelected every 2 years, to be informed on this and to resist it, we will lose the United States of America within the next 10 years.
I'm not sure we have 10 years, Dr. Carson.
Within the next 5, it could happen.
Right.
And George Bush, like Peter DeFazio says, the word that stuck in my mind all day today was hell-bent. Because Peter DeFazio said George Bush is hell-bent to open the United States to Mexican trucks. And those words rang in my head all day, because hell-bent, I think, describes it. This is not a plan that comes from God's desire to preserve individual liberty and freedom of the United States of America. And I hate to say that, but there's no other conclusion I can come to.
I think you're absolutely right. And, of course, those who listen to our program regularly know that there are powerful spiritual forces behind this whole move to bring about a new world order, a new world religion, and, of course, a new world leader. Well, Dr. Corsi, it's always a pleasure to have you here with us, and I just appreciate so much your dedication and getting the word out. And we'll do everything we can to get your book distributed far and wide. God bless you, and thank you so very much for being with us again here at Radio Liberty.
God bless you, Stan. It's a great honor, as always, to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, our guest has been Dr. Jerome Corsi, and we do hope that many of you will certainly want to get his material. You can go up to the WorldNet Daily and pull it down. We'll be... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Dr. Corsi was saying that today at one of the congressmen, Congressman Fazio, had said there in the congressional conference that the president is hell-bent upon taking us into this new North American Union. He's hell-bent, and Dr. Crazy said those words rang in his head all day long, because he doesn't think this is of God, and I can assure you it's not. And those of you who've seen our material will realize there are powerful spiritual forces behind this move towards the New World Order, the New World Religion, and, of course, the New World Leader. If you haven't seen our three pamphlets set on the occult hierarchy, you need to get them and read them through. You need, of course, to read our February newsletter. It's up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. Now, we carry Dr. Corsi's excellent book, The Late Great USA. We recommend it to you. We think it's very important. We have a four-tape set on globalism, the secret threat. We have a four-tape set on the impending police state. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on the North American community, the demise of national sovereignty. That's the globalism, the secret threat, which takes you into the background of this thousands of year old program to bring about a world government that's coming to fruition just today. The impending police state, which goes into the Military Commissions Act and the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act and the other legislation which has been laid out to allow a dictatorship in America. People said that couldn't be true. It couldn't be true, and I would ask, why not? If God is just, don't you think he's going to bring judgment on America? And then, of course, the four-tape set on the North American community, subtitled The Demise of National Sovereignty. The information is here in our tape sets, and certainly we recommend that you get those along with, of course, the book, The Late Great USA. That's The Late Great USA. You need to have the information. And you need to be able to quote from it. If you'd like to get the information on the concentration camps, we have a clipping we took from the newspaper where it tells us, about a year or more ago, about how we're giving $385 million a year to Halliburton, or Halliburton's subsidiary, to stand by to build those concentration camps. Why do you think we're giving him $385 million a day? To stand by to build concentration camps? Don't you think maybe they intend to have them build concentration camps? And who's going to go into these concentration camps? And don't think that you're going to be left alone, because when freedom fails, good men rot in filthy jails. And those who cry appease, appease, are often hanged or tortured to death by those they hope to please. It could happen in America, because if God is just, he's going to bring the judgment on us. Because men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. If you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, seen my talk on the secret, on the forbidden secret, it comes with a syllabus, and it takes you into the background of the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. That's a term the president used twice in his inaugural speech on the 20th of January 2001, I should say. The angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. And we'll explain to you who that angel is who rides in the whirlwind and is behind everything going on today. Certainly the DVDs by Chris Pinto, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, give you the background of everything's happening from a biblical and scriptural point of view. And then The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning by Chris Pinto, award-winning DVD. And then The Secrets, Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. If you're interested, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And, well, for the next hour, we're going to have with us Mr. William Grigg, formerly one of the chief editors of the New American magazine and certainly one of the most insightful authors and observers on the scene today. It's always a pleasure to have him here. And William, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Dr. Stan, great to be with you again.
Well, tell us what the issues are that you'd like to talk about tonight.
I think the most recent occurrence that a lot of people have been discussing, certainly in the blogosphere and on talk radio over the last 24 hours, was the debate last night in New Hampshire, and particularly the performance of Ron Paul and the confrontation between him and former Governor Huckabee of Arkansas.
Well, wasn't that magnificent?
That was. I think that the most impressive thing about this is that to the halfway intelligent observer, it was clear that the people who had orchestrated these events, and these are not debates in any sense that most people would recognize for the most part, they're sometimes referred to as beauty pageants. Somebody once said that politics was show business for ugly people, so in that sense it could be called a beauty pageant, I suppose. And also joint press conferences. But they had one of these going on last night when a debate broke out between Paul and Huckabee. And the thing that impressed me was that, once again, the stagecraft was quite obvious. Somehow, the people running this debate and producing it for television consumption had managed to station somebody with an earshot who seemed to be heckling and laughing derisively at everything Ron Paul said. And I suspect it was somebody on the stage with him. I don't know for sure. That the fact that the audience, of course, was heavily seasoned with diehard, cultishly devoted Bushbot Republicans. And the tenor of the questions that were given to Ron Paul, the so-called debate went 30 or 40 minutes before anybody even deigned to throw a question Ron Paul's direction. But the questions that were delivered to him were loaded to the point of being booby-trapped. And so everything was engineered in a way to try to make him look as bad as possible. And he knew that going in. He knew that he was entering the proverbial lion's den and that the lions were packing heat. And in spite of that, he displayed not so much as a tremor of hesitation in standing up for his principles. He was composed. His sentences, unlike those of everybody else on the stage, parsed quite well. And they were laden with principle, fact, and content. And the fact that he was willing to address the fundamental moral question of the war in Iraq so candidly and so forcefully when he was dealing with somebody who's an insipid slogan spewer like Mr. Huckabee was something that really impressed me, particularly when we start discussing this whole matter of whether honor requires that we continue to kill and send men to kill and die on behalf of what is manifestly a wrong-headed, dishonest policy. That was Huckabee's position. It matters not whether or not it was the right thing to do. It simply is a matter of honor. In this case, by honor, he means reputation, prestige, face for the Bush administration, for the federal government, for the entire political establishment. This is something which I think cuts right to the heart of what the Republican Party has become, unfortunately. The Republican leadership is, I think, in the grasp of people who are cultic in their outlook. You're talking here about honor killings. You know, honor killings of the sort that are mass murder for the sake of upholding the political reputation of people at the top of the governing pyramid. That's something not unique in our history, but it's certainly, I think, uniquely unsettling that it's become so widespread and so pronounced.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Of course, the really interesting thing about Ron Paul's response was, in so many words, Ron Paul saying, you know, how many people are we going to kill? How much more are we going to pay so that you can save face? You know, that was probably the breakthrough moment in the entire debate last night, or in any of the debates that have occurred so far. Ron Paul had a wonderful moment a couple of debates ago when he was asked what the most important moral question of our time was, and he said the most important moral question is contained in the fact that we as a party and as a government and to a large extent as a country have embraced the concept of preemptive aggressive war in defiance of the Christian just war tradition. I was amazed that he was able to say that with such composure, and that he provoked a pretty favorable reaction from some members of the crowd there in South Carolina. Well, last night, the fact that he was willing to say that the only reason why the killing continues at the political level, I mean, there are deeper things that you and I have discussed, Dr. Stan, in terms of the unseen tectonics of the issue, but in terms of the way that this is being sold to the public, the only thing that's being discussed now is the idea of saving face. And George W. Bush, in recent days, it has been revealed, has candidly admitted that he just wants to keep troops stationed in Iraq under whatever pretext for as long as possible so as to make it a matter of political comfort for his successor, be he or she from whichever of the two retail outlets for the establishment party, will feel obliged to keep that presence perpetually in the Middle East. He just wants to create a permanent foothold there. He's admitted this. He was playing for October, November, is what the phrase was recorded in the new biography, Dead Certainties, based on interviews, extensive interviews with George W. Bush and other people. And, of course, Ron Paul, being a decent and moral man, would have none of that. You just cannot conceive, at least I cannot conceive, of the type of a mindset that somebody would have that would dictate that it is a good, just, and moral thing to send men to kill and die and women to kill and die simply to preserve the prestige of a president and a ruling elite. It's abhorrent. And God bless Ron Paul for saying that last night. And the reaction he provoked was really quite encouraging because, obviously, by virtue of the metrics that were used to measure audience response, except for the little focus group that was put together by Fox News under the direction of Frank Luntz last night, that was the only group that said that somebody other than Ron Paul had won that debate, and every other metric illustrates that he won it resoundingly. So to that extent, it was not only a useful thing, but it was also, I think, an encouraging thing in however limited a sense we might assign to it.
Well, I think it was really, really, it gave you almost a sense of hope to realize that there is a man of integrity out there running for the presidency. We'll mm-hmm. be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sidney William Krieg is talking about the debate last night. You can actually see most of this up on Prison Planet on the YouTube there, and you can put in just the... was that the New Hampshire debate?
Where yes.
Was New Hampshire debate, YouTube, and or Prison Planet YouTube. Excellent, and of course, the whole idea of Huckabee was, well, let's not talk about whether we should have gone in. We did go in, we broke it, and now we got to fix it. Well, mm-hmm. of course, the idea that we broke it, now we got to fix it, and maybe we shouldn't have gone in the first place, but sure. Now it's broken, you know, and of course, if we pull out, there's going to be a lot of chaos, a lot of killing, and of course, Ron Paul's point that he made so well was look, I mean, the same people who tell you there's going to be chaos and killing if we pull out are the same people who told us that this was going to be a cakewalk, there was going to be nothing to it, we were going to win easily. They were wrong then. Why should we believe what they say now?
Yeah,
that was such a good point.
Yeah, exactly. The architects of this enterprise have a track record that is unblemished by success. That being the case, they're certainly not reliable prognosticators of what will happen if we abandon their master strategy. But the thing I find really interesting about Huckabee's analysis here, if you want to use that word to describe something that was so consummately dishonest, is the fact that he assumes that it is the duty of the American people with our treasure and the very lifeblood of our veins, the form of our children, our husbands and wives, our sons and daughters, to indemnify the dishonest errors that were made by our ruling class. We were deceived. The entire American public, apart from those like yourself and myself and a few others, who are on to the game right from the beginning, most people who are passive consumers of what passes for news in this country were stampeded, cynically manipulated into supporting something that was a patent compound of lies. having been lied and manipulated into accepting something that is the result of fraud, now we're being told that by virtue of being deceived, they are compelled now to support the continuation of this deceit at whatever cost in terms of our economic strength, at whatever cost in terms of not only the men and women who die, but the ones who are left horribly maimed, disfigured, insane, incapable of conducting a normal, rational life after they come back from that horrible experience. You know, that's the position that is wrapped up in Mike Huckabee's smug little sound bites about honor. And quite frankly, when I heard him start talking about honor, it reminded me of something that John Randolph once said about Daniel Webster. Obviously, these two guys did not like each other a whole lot. John Randolph once said to Daniel Webster that the word honor in the mouth of Daniel Webster is like the word love in the mouth of a whore. And that's what I was thinking as I heard Huckabee prattling on about honor last night. The man is a stranger in the house of honor. And he's also somebody who is a patent fraud as a purported Christian. And I'll tell you why I say that. Last night, there was one of these candidates among this riotous orgy of absolutely horrifying collectivism. You had people like Duncan Hunter and Tom Tancredo. Tom Tancredo, I think, is quite frankly irrational, talking about aggressive war and praising torture. You had Tancredo embracing the idea of waterboarding. He wouldn't call that torture. Oddly enough, it was prosecuted as a war crime by the Japanese. The Imperial Japanese used waterboarding, and the interrogators who used that method were prosecuted as war criminals. So, yeah, we're on record. You know, the American government is on record as saying that's a form of torture. The communist Khmer Rouge used waterboarding. It was their single most effective tool, as a matter of fact, in terms of ensuring compliance and tormenting people into cooperating with their investigations. But you had all this going on. The single most appalling thing that was said, I think, was once again Herr Huckabee talking about the idea of being able to track human beings like packages, using some kind of a system akin to what Federal Express and UPS and other overnight services use to track the delivery of a package. This, of course, would be his solution to the problem of illegal immigration. And I said to my wife, after reviewing that, that it just figures that the fellow masquerading as a man of the cloth, as a Christian pastor, would be the one who would most volubly embrace the mark of the beast. That's the thing that I find really interesting. Whether or not you agree with the apocalyptic connotations of that phrase, when somebody talks about the idea of a human inventory control system, he's talking about a totalitarian mechanism, whether you assign to it the eschatological significance that a lot of people would have, that it would be the system described in the book of Revelation. I'm not saying that that specific mechanism is what Huckabee is talking about, but in principle it doesn't differ a whole lot from what most people have thought of in terms of how the Mark of the Beast would operate. And this is the fellow who was upbraiding Ron Paul for being insufficiently zealous in upholding the supposed honor of the degenerate government that lied our country into a war. So, once again, it was just so refreshing to see somebody who would stand tall and firm and not retreat one inch from a principled position in spite of the fact that everything was rigged to make him look like a fool for taking the position and holding to the position in defiance of the party's orthodoxy. And of course today, the minions and lickspittles and the employ of the Republican Party from that silly little beetle-browed nitwit Sean Hannity to others who've been invited to the White House to become more or less mouthpieces of the regime have been trying to convince people that Ron Paul really stepped in it last night. And, of course, the truth is exactly the opposite. The reason they're targeting him is because he's finding traction. He's making progress. And I think the fact that he's suffering the second and third stage aftershock attacks by the administration and its minions is something encouraging as well.
Well, I thought it was really very interesting. Of course, at one point, Ron Paul talks about how we got in there, and he said our foreign policy was hijacked by the neocons. Mm-hmm. And this small little group of people took us into this war that the American people didn't want, that the Congress didn't want, and then, of course, Huckabee comes back. Well, we are a united people. We're mm-hmm. not just, we are not divided. We are a united people, one nation under God, fighting for honor. And then I'm sitting there just shaking my head. You know, we're not united. I mean, certainly the majority of the people wants to get out of this. He may think the people are united, but he has no contact with reality. The vast majority of the American people feel that we're in a terrible situation. We should get out.
Yeah.
The majority want to get out. George Bush's ratings are probably the lowest of any president I can ever remember at any time, even lower than that of Bill Clinton back at the time of his escapade with Monica Lewinsky.
Mm-hmm.
And here is Huckabee saying, why, we are united people behind this war. And what hypocrisy.
Well, it's something much worse than hypocrisy. The reason why I refer to him as Herr Huckabee is because his doctrine of, you could call it national unity, or you could call it unitary government, is best when translated into the German. He's speaking about Führerprinzip, the leader principle. The idea that George W. Bush, as the head of the executive branch, somehow embodies the general will of the American public. That's an idea that started with Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the totalitarians who staged the French Revolution and fed the guillotine in 1793 and a number of years afterward. That's the doctrine of Napoleon, the squalid little diseased Corsican who inherited the mantle of the French Revolution and fought all manner of wars of conquest in the name of democracy, and that included a side trip to Egypt to try to democratize the Middle East, and it went about as well as the venture that George W. Bush is in charge of today. And you can trace that thread all the way through to Hitler and the National Socialists. The idea, once again, was that by virtue of heading the executive branch, the grand and glorious leader, the Führer, or the decider, however you want to characterize the head of the executive branch, is the true voice of the people, irrespective of whether or not the people at any given time have consciously given him support for his policies. It doesn't matter. By virtue of having received that anointing as the head of the executive branch, he represents their best interests, often in defiance of their transitory opinions. You remember when Bush, in December of 2004, in the full smug malignance of his completely unearned self-regard, said something to the effect of, we had an accountability moment in November, a few weeks ago. So it doesn't really matter whether or not we went into Iraq for the right reasons. The fact was, he got reelected, which ratified everything he did, no matter how dishonest, no matter how duplicitous, no matter what the people would subsequently learn, and no matter how their opinions would change. That was his accountability moment, and from that time on, he basically had carte blanche. That's what Huckabee was peddling last night. And the thing that I find really interesting here is that this line was presented in somewhat different terms by a putrescent little talk show host in Portland by the name of Lars Larson. He was one of the people who went to the White House a few weeks ago. He summoned to the White House to go out and preach the message of support the surge, support the continuation of the war, the further entrenchment of the United States in Iraq. When the bombing begins against Iran, he'll be one of the most voluble cheerleaders. But in his take on what happened, he replayed and very dishonestly cropped the soundbite of the confrontation between Huckabee and Ron Paul. And what he said was that when Ron Paul talked about the small clique of neocons who hijacked a foreign policy, Larson went on to say, oh, no, you're a member of Congress, and Congress voted to authorize the war, which, of course, is not true. Ron Paul, in late 2002, proposed a resolution to declare war on Iraq. He proposed a formal declaration of war against the Iraqi government, as the Constitution requires. That is, the only legitimate way to commit our government to a war is by a formal declaration by Congress, not a resolution that would defer that decision to the executive branch. Congress has no constitutional authority to delegate that power to the executive branch. It has to declare war. It has to have an up-and-down recorded vote. That bill didn't get out of its committee. Ron Paul did not vote for his own bill. He simply said, we've got to put people on record. If we're going to go to war, and it's apparent that the people who hijacked our foreign policy intend to, we have to have them on record, up or down, regarding a resolution declaring war. It didn't even get out of the committee. So Congress did not authorize the war in Iraq. They abdicated that power to the executive branch and the people who were running at this neocon cabal.
And of course, he was absolutely right. This is a neocon cabal. And as Ron Paul pointed out, the Republicans are losing elections, and he said, we're going to lose completely next year unless we get out of Iraq. And of course, he's absolutely right, but by then, we will probably also be at war with the Muslim world.
Oh, man.
go right ahead.
What a charming prospect that is, too.
Well, I really believe everything points in the direction that we are going to war with Iran. It doesn't matter what the American people want. It doesn't matter, of course, what the Iranian people want. It doesn't matter that certainly all of our allies are abandoning us. The British are pulling their troops out. Almost every other country has pulled their troops out. We are going to be standing all alone, plunging into a war with the entire 1.25 billion Muslim people throughout the world. And that's a frightening thing to contemplate.
That's a horrifying thing. And the interesting contradiction that you sort of address here or allude to has to do with, once again, what Huckabee was trying to say about how the country is united behind the war. He's saying two eminently contradictory things. Yeah, the first of which is that we are a united country, must be united, one nation under God. God in this instance being the state, apparently. And on the other hand, when Ron Paul brought up the fact that the Republicans are losing elections because they're not paying attention to popular sentiment that wants us to withdraw from Iraq, Huckabee said, well, it's more important that we maintain our honor than we win elections. Well, which is it, Huckabee? Make up what passes for your mind. Are we united behind the war, or are we united against the war to such an extent that the honorable thing to do is to prolong the war in spite of the fact that the whole country is against it? When you're dealing with somebody who's a double-minded man, he's unstable in all his ways. Now, Huckabee professes to be a Christian pastor. He's acquainted with that passage in the book of James. He just ignores it when he's serving his true God, which is the state.
And then I thought there was one point, of course, where the question here says, well, Mr. Paul, I mean, you want to pull out. Then do you think that we ought to let Al-Qaeda dictate American foreign policy?
Yeah, that was...
And, of course, it was one of the times when Ron Paul showed a little emotion, and I was proud of any point.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, absolutely not. Yeah. And then he went on to
say... Yeah, we don't take our marching orders from Al-Qaeda. We take our marching orders from the Constitution.
Right.
The thing about Ron Paul, and I've met him, and I know that you've met him as well, and everybody who has had the experience of talking with him for any length of time realizes a couple of things. The first of which is that there is no affectation to the guy. What you see is what you get. I mean, he only keeps one face. He displays the same face in all circumstances. And the second thing about him is that he is very tranquil. He's somebody who is eminently comfortable in his own skin. He's somebody who knows exactly what he believes and why he believes the way he does. And this is the thing that I find impressive. I've spoken with a number of people who have had this experience. If you present him with a compelling argument that strikes him as defensible and factual, he'll change his mind. He won't change his principles. He'll just change his opinion to bring them more thoroughly into harmony with his principles. And so he's somebody who is very difficult to rile on account of the fact that he really keeps himself out of most things. He's not defending an ego. He's not defending a product. He's not trying to preserve a carefully crafted and focus group approved image. He just is who he is, and he's willing to lose. He's somebody who is willing to lose on a matter of principle. I quite frankly couldn't vote for somebody who wouldn't be willing to lose on a matter of principle. But last night, in spite of the fact you're dealing with somebody who is so mild-mannered and so serene, there was that moment when suddenly you saw the gunslinger eyes come out, and you realized that, yes, there is some steel in this guy's spine, and if you mess with him, he will mess with you, and you'll get messed up. And so when Chris Wallace smugly threw up this Republican National Committee field-tested talking point about how basically if you oppose the president, you're on the side of Al-Qaeda,
he got that shoved right down his throat. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is talking about the debate last night. If you did not see it, you can go up on YouTube, and the Prison Planet has a number of the more important encounters. And Ron Paul did a magnificent job of defending his position, against all comers, including the questioners, who were supposed to be impartial. And yet, of course, they weren't. And, of course, one of the points that was made by the questionnaire, oh, well, of course, you want to pull out of Iraq. You want Al-Qaeda, to dictate American policy. Well, of course, my answer would have been, no, of course, Al-Qaeda wants us to stay there.
Sure.
They encourage us to come in. In fact, if you read what Osama bin Laden had said before we attacked wanted us there because they knew this was a place, of course, we would be trapped in a quagmire. Why is it then that the Republican Party wants us to follow the dictates of Al-Qaeda rather than free ourselves from this octopus that's strangling the very heart of our party?
I simply can't understand why it is that otherwise intelligent people seem to think that Osama bin Laden did not want us to invade Iraq when Iraq was governed by a regime that of Saddam Hussein that was considered a heretical infidel regime by Osama bin Laden, first of all. And secondly, when it provided him with means of, assuming of course that A, he's still alive, and that B, he actually has a hands-on role in managing global jihad. I'm a skeptic about both of those points.
I think you're right.
Let's assume that he's alive and that he is actually somebody with a significant role in organizing and training and managing the global jihad. It would be to his tremendous advantage to have a number of divisions of Americans pinned down in Mesopotamia where he can train and give field experience to second and third and fourth generation jihadists. It's an incomparable opportunity. I mean, logistically, it's all to his advantage to have us pinned down there, to have the flies conquered the fly paper, to use the expression from John Steinbeck's novel, The Moon Is Down, about the Nazi occupation of an unnamed European country. At some point, you realize that the logic of occupation means that you're going to lose, because all that the resistance has to do, whether it's a legitimate resistance, whether they're insurgents or guerrilla fighters, all they have to do to win is stay there. Eventually, you're going home. And so the logic of occupation is that the resistance is eventually going to win unless you simply destroy the entire country, which, of course, begs the question of why you bother to occupy in the first place. The other thing that happens, of course, and this is something that Martin Van Creveld, the Israeli military strategist, has pointed out, is that asymmetrical warfare of this sort always works to the advantage of the weaker party, because they always have the initiative in terms of learning and improving their skills and improving their tactics. And eventually, as the occupation drags on, you're dealing with a cannier and more experienced and more capable enemy until such time as you end up getting driven out ignominiously when you had the initiative of leaving once your military objectives were already achieved. So I think that anybody who's got so much as a smattering, and I don't have much more than a smattering, of learning with respect to strategy would understand that the best thing that could ever have been done for Osama bin Laden, assuming, of course, that Osama bin Laden is the uber lord of terrorism, of popular myth, would be for the United States to invade Iraq and, first of all, create a huge backlash in the Muslim world, which creates a windfall in terms of recruiting for jihad, and secondly, providing on-site, on-the-scene, on-the-job training for the next generation of jihadists, whether they're from Iraq, or from Iran, or from Saudi Arabia, which is where most of them come from, or elsewhere in the Muslim world. Did you read, Stan, Greg Palast's book, Armed Madhouse?
Yes, I did.
Do you remember what he had to say about the almost completely ignored element of Osama bin Laden's ultimatum, and the one thing that really stuck in his teeth was the way that oil prices were falling? And that with the decline in the oil prices, you had, of course, some misfortune being visited on the economy of Saudi Arabia. And, of course, that's what Osama bin Laden was relying on, was the fact that the Saudi economy would remain very robust, and he'd end up getting them to pay him the Dane Geld, so to speak. And how Osama bin Laden and then Dick Cheney and George W. Bush all wanted to bring about an increase in the price of oil.
In fact, the price of oil was really down around $10 an ounce there at $10 a barrel at one time early in the Bush administration. And, of course, we're told we went into Iraq because we wanted to secure the oil there for America. And isn't it nice we can get it at $70 a barrel now? And what they've effectively done is skyrocket the price of oil, enrich the oil barons, certainly the six remaining sisters in the oil business. And was that what this was really all about from the very beginning, was a rise in the price of oil? We're going to be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, William Grieg. And, of course, you know, we are really very, very fortunate today because, of course, we have the access to the Internet we've never had before. And for anyone, of course, who wonders, well, certainly Osama bin Laden could be dead. If he's dead, wouldn't our government tell us? I would like to suggest that that's the last thing they would want to do.
Sure.
The last thing they would want you to know is that Osama bin Laden is dead, because, after all, we have to have a boogeyman to frighten the American people. And so we do have the Internet, and I would like to suggest that you go up on Google and Google in Osama bin Laden is dead, or Osama bin Laden died, and you'll find hundreds of references to this fact. This is a man who was in dialysis. Dialysis is a very complicated manner. You have to be in the hospital to do it. Now, we're told Osama bin Laden is living in a cave somewhere, so secretive we can't find him. It was amazing that just a few weeks before the 9/11 attack, he was in the hospital in Dubai, getting, of course, his dialysis, with the full support of the American Central Intelligence Agency that knew he was responsible for the bombing of the Cole, and of course, USS Cole, and the attacks on our embassies in both in Tanzania and Kenya. And yet, of course, you can look that up on the Internet, or we can provide the articles for you if you'd like to see them. So, you know, how has this man been able to survive without dialysis for all this length of time? Usually within 2 weeks, you know, if you don't have another dialysis treatment, you're dead.
Yeah.
And, of course, the stories are out there. And you look them up on the Internet, you'll find all sorts of stories and hits about the fact that Osama bin Laden's been dead for a long time. But if we didn't have Osama bin Laden, who would we have to fear? How could we rally the people behind the government if there weren't an enemy out there? And we've got to give up our freedom, or Osama bin Laden's going to take it away.
Well, the really interesting thing about that entire description of the myth or the legend of Osama bin Laden is the aspect of him living in a cave somewhere in a mountain redoubt in Afghanistan or Pakistan, and the idea that somebody who is living in Stone Age conditions, albeit supplemented with satellite phones and other high-tech gear, would be in a position to destroy the freedom of the United States. I mean, granted, if you subscribe to the entire model of what happened on 9/11 that has been presented to us by the custodians of respectable opinion, even if you subscribe to all this, if you stipulate to the idea that all this was done as it has been described countless times in movies and documentaries and so forth, I still don't see where you're talking about something that represents an existential threat to the United States of America.
Hold that thought, William. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just saying that certainly we've been told that Osama bin Laden is a threat to America, was behind what happened on the 911. Of course, if you go to the FBI, the 10 Most Wanted website, and pull down their FBI poster on Osama bin Laden, nobody's told the FBI that Osama bin Laden was responsible for what happened on 9/11, and you can read there the Most Wanted poster. They tell you what he's wanted for, but not one mention of what happened on September 11th, 6 years ago. And so we have to ask, is it that the Bush administration has never told the FBI what happened that day, who was really behind it, or is it possible that the Bush administration has not been entirely forthright with this? And then, of course, William's point is, I mean, it's very, very difficult to believe that a man severely ill with kidney failure, living on dialysis in a cave over there in Pakistan, is threatening the freedom of the American people, and is going to take away our freedom unless, of course, we go along with the surveillance programs they have here, and we all have ID cards, and we have video cameras on everything, and they can listen to our telephone calls, and they can read our emails and our faxes, because that's how we're going to protect ourselves from the vicious, you know, angry, hostile, dangerous Osama bin Laden living in the cave. Go ahead.
Well, speaking of the idea of surrendering our privacy, and how the Bush administration has been trying to convince everybody that unless we're willing to submit to our rulers and in their every whim, that we'll be attacked by the evildoers and destroyed. You're probably aware of the recent revelations about what David Addington, the chief of staff to Dick Cheney, said, in I believe it was February of 2004, there's a book coming out in a couple of weeks called The Terror Presidency, which is which was written by Jack Goldsmith, who is the former head of the Department of Legal Counsel for the Justice Department. And he's somebody who is really signed on to the entire agenda of the regime. He believes that it's necessary that you have extraordinary rendition, which is to say extrajudicial kidnapping and delivery of people into the hands of regimes that commit torture, and enhanced interrogation techniques, which is the same expression used by the German National Socialist government to describe the same things that our government does now to terrorist detainees. He believes in the idea that the president should have the ability to designate anybody, including an American citizen, an unlawful enemy combatant, summarily imprison that person, order that he be tortured or even killed summarily. In other words, this Jack Goldsmith believes all these things. He just believes it was important that Congress be more thoroughly involved in ratifying all these policies so as to make them more legitimate, whereas people like David Addington, chief of staff for Dick Cheney, believes that Congress is an irrelevant institution and the executive branch is all that matters, and the judicial branch as well is at best an occasional hindrance. What Jack Goldsmith said on or in February of 2004, what David Addington said, according to Jack Goldsmith, back in December, February 2004, was the following, referring to the Foreign Intelligence Security Act, or the FISA court, which could issue warrants after the fact for a wiretap. This is what Addington said, quote, "We're one bomb away from getting rid of that obnoxious court." Now, who's the we he's referring to? You'd have to think that the we would be the Bush administration, obviously, but also whoever it would be who would carry out that terrorist act, that in order to bring about a crisis that would justify the eradication of checks and balances on warrantless wiretaps, warrantless surveillance, a full-fledged, real-time, all-encompassing surveillance of everything that we say by way of telephone or electronically throughout a means. You'd have to have some kind of a cataclysmic terrorist act that would stampede the public into accepting this. The other part of the we, apart from the Bush administration, would have to be the terrorists. It seems to me that that statement is something very close to a confession of a desire to collaborate with our announced foreign enemy, or perhaps even an allusion to a type of collaboration that has occurred up to that point. If there is another witness to that statement by David Addington, the man should be arrested and brought to book on a charge of treason, in the sense that he was adhering to our enemies, and that he was actually talking about making war against the institutions of our constitutional government. I'm not trying to say that he would therefore be convicted of that charge. What I'm saying is if you have two witnesses to that statement, and you can deduce the positive acts that would be part of this collaboration, the guy really should be brought to book and really squeezed to find out exactly what he meant by that, and who else might be privy to that particular perspective on what's going on. I wrote that in my blog a couple of days ago, and it created some controversy because people were saying, well, you're talking about prosecuting somebody for the equivalent of a thought crime. I say, no, I'm not. You're dealing with somebody here who had a very exalted position in our government, who was making what could be a quasi-confession of collaboration. And you need to find out exactly what he meant by that, because the one thing that would justify this guy receiving a paycheck from the U.S. taxpayers would be that he would be working to protect us from terrorism, as opposed to courting terrorism as a way to bring about the consolidation of power in the executive. And so really, the screws need to be put to that guy, and of course they won't, but they really should be. But that, I think, is much more exemplary of the mindset of the Bush administration than just about anything else I've read in the public record, and it's quite frankly terrifying.
Well, I certainly agree with you. In fact, if you read the original Patriot Act, why, of course, they define terrorism as those who would change our form of government.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
And of course, who wants to change our form of government? Why, of course, the people in the Bush administration, because mm-hmm. they're globalists, they want to do away with national sovereignty. So by their definition of the legislation that they have enacted, they are terrorists. Anybody, of course, who embraces no socialism or the North American Union or the doing away with the national sovereignty of our name, of our nation, has now, of course, by their very legislation that's been enacted, they are terrorists, and they are traitors to our country.
It'd be wonderful to see them hoist by that particular petard, hoist by the Patriot Act petard, as it were, particularly given the promiscuous misuse of that already egregious law. There is in Phoenix a spectacularly obnoxious prosecutor by the name of Andrew Payton Thomas. He's the county attorney for Maricopa County, long-suffering Maricopa County. He, within the last 4 or 5 months, used the Patriot Act to accuse a junior high school-aged boy of terrorism because, for whatever reason, this little miscreant pulled his pocket knife on one of his fellow students on the way to school. And there wasn't really any reason not to charge him with the authentically serious charge, for instance, of armed assault. That's a very serious charge. Assault with a potentially deadly weapon, I'd say that's a very serious charge. But no, this grandstanding, self-enraptured Republican prosecutor obviously wants to move up in the world. Said, well, we have this Patriot Act, this federal law that says in, I can't believe what specific provision, although I've studied this and I was able to verify that the provision does exist, that if you commit some kind of an act that interferes with the conduct of business in a government entity, such as a school, specifically, that's an act of terrorism. And so he used the Patriot Act to charge this, once again, badly misbehaving young boy with terrorism as a way of extorting from him a plea bargain, no doubt, because that's what prosecutors do nowadays. They do everything they can to try to prevent cases from going to trial where an actual jury would decide whether or not the accused is guilty of committing crimes against a person's or property. They want to plea bargain everything rather than letting citizens have a role in the administration of justice. But that's an example of how the Patriot Act has been used in very malignantly creative ways to undermine due process. Now, in the case of somebody like David Addington, you've got somebody who obviously wants to change our form of government, whether you subscribe, as you and I both do, on the basis of the facts, subscribe to the belief that they're globalists who are bent on destroying national sovereignty as it has been defined for over 200 years. You got to admit that they are trying to change the form of government by destroying all institutional checks on the presidency and leaving the executive branch the dominant rather than co-equal element of the federal government. And he's talking about exploiting terrorism toward that end. So that, on the basis of what we can document in the public record, would be pretty good grounds for a Patriot Act prosecution, which would be simply delicious. Of course, as a principled man, or somebody who aspires to be a principled man, I'd have to say no. I don't even want David Addington to face prosecution under the Patriot Act. I'd rather see the Patriot Act repealed. But there is still this whole question of whether there was actual collaboration of some sort going on, and that's certainly worthy of both a congressional investigation and, I think, quite frankly, a grand jury investigation. It's not going to happen. It'd be wonderful if it did.
Well, I'm very much afraid that we'll never find out exactly what happened on 911, but the one thing we do know, and that is that we've not been told the truth, because, of course, the administration has effectively blocked any independent evaluation of the evidence, and during the 911 commission investigation, there were 1,200 people who were interviewed in secret and in total secret, and 1,100 of those testimonies have been sealed for 50 years. So 11/12 of what was learned by the commission was sealed, and we were only given the 1/12 of the testimony that fit into the official story. And I'd like to know what was in that other testimony. Well, 50 years from now, I will know. And if there's nothing to conceal, then why did they conceal it?
Exactly. Now, the other thing that we have to recognize here is that there was an off-the-shelf plan, so to speak, not only for Department of Homeland Security. That was something that was on George W. Bush's desk in February or March of 2001, but also for this grand military campaign in the Middle East, which is why almost immediately, and by almost immediately, I mean within hours of the events of the morning of 9/11, you had a plan in place and already functioning to bring about a war with Iraq.
Well, you know, it's really what's so interesting is that if you read certainly Donald Rumsfeld's testimony, mm-hmm. and you can actually read it on page, you know, of 161, I believe, of the book Without Precedent by Thomas Keene and Lee Hamilton. On page 161, they quote Donald Rumsfeld as saying that it was just they'd been working on a plan of how they were going to handle Al-Qaeda and the situation in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
and that plan was completed on the 10th of September, the day before. Now, what are the chances they would have completed the plan the day before the 9/11 attack, and then within 3 weeks they were able to have troops on the ground in Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
How long does it take to plan a military action? Why, it takes many, many months. But they had troops on the ground within 3 weeks going after Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Only, of course, they would not allow them to go after Osama bin Laden, and when he was trapped in the Tora Bora Mountains, instead of course allowing the troops to get him, while they hired some Afghan mercenaries, many who supported Osama bin Laden, and what do you know, he escapes into Pakistan, and then, instead of letting our troops go after him and capturing him and ending this whole conflict with terrorism, they changed the plan, and now we're going to go to war with Iraq.
Exactly.
And now, of course, they're going to change the plan again.
Yep.
Now we're going to go to war with Iran. And,
yep.
and who knows who will go to war with after that. And where's the money coming from? Where is the outcry from our Christian leaders?
I know.
And they're all embracing this because this is a just war. This is just torture. When was the last time you heard your minister speak out against torture, torturing the prisoners, the helpless prisoners, many who probably don't know anything?
Oh, almost none of them. I mean, the population in Guantanamo, you're dealing with a handful, maybe a couple of dozen, who actually had something to do with terrorism. Most of them were scooped up by bounty hunters who were operating on purely mercenary motives, and they were getting so much money ahead for anybody who happened to be caught up in their canvas when they were going out and trying to deliver so-called terrorism suspects into the hands of the CIA and the military. But you're entirely correct, Stan, when you talk about the fact that we are seeing the build-up, the obvious rollout of the next phase of the war, which would be with Iran. And I think one of the good things about what happened in New Hampshire last night at the so-called debate was that people started to talk about what Ron Paul had to say about Iraq, and that's somewhat detracting from the momentum that Dick Cheney had ordered would be imparted to the drive for war, to war with Iran. I mean, it's something that was revealed a week and a half or so ago, that he basically issued marching orders to the so-called American Enterprise Institute and a number of other warrens of neocon propagandists and scribblers and scriveners to start tuning the public atmosphere for action against Iran. And one thing that you probably noticed as well, as I have, is this really eerie story about this unauthorized flight of a B-52 from North Dakota to the B-52 base in Barksdale, Louisiana, earlier this week or last week. I can't remember exactly when it took place, but it crossed the heartland of the United States with six nuclear-armed cruise missiles under its wings. Now, that's something that has been described as, to use a vulgar expression, a snafu. But the really interesting thing is that the Barksdale, Louisiana B-52 base is the staging area for delivering arms and aircraft to the Middle East. And so if you're going to be using cruise missiles in a strike on Iran, they would have to be shipped out of the Barksdale Air Force Base. And that's the part of this whole story that's got me really curious and somewhat unsettled right now.
Well, I think we really should be because, of course, these are nuclear weapons. And, of course, if we were to use nuclear weapons against Iran, we would, of course, have broken all precedent. And if we were to use nuclear weapons on Iran, would we have any justification for objecting to nuclear weapons to be used on American cities? That is the question that nobody wants to raise, nobody wants to ask. This would be madness to even consider using nuclear weapons there, and yet I believe that there is a very good possibility that they intend to do it. And ladies and gentlemen, I saw Europe following the Second World War. I was a military officer. I saw the rubble of the cities of Germany and France, and I would hate to think that one day I would see that here in America. But of course, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And who is speaking out, as William is tonight, about the very real possibility that we may be planning a preemptive use of nuclear weapons against those wicked people in Iran.
It's almost inconceivable that we've reached this turn of affairs, that we've reached this juncture in our nation's history, but here we are. And once again, the only one of the Republican presidential candidates has spoken out against this is Ron Paul, and he's treated as a moonbat for suggesting that there is something morally wrong with preemptive use of nuclear weapons. That's how far we've come.
Amen to that. Well, we're in real trouble, as far as morality, as far as integrity, and we're totally without leadership in either the Christian or conservative community. And certainly, we have one man in Congress who's speaking out, and of course, he's ridiculed by the mass media and his fellow Republicans. Well, William, I get so involved with our conversation, I keep forgetting to get your blog and your website out there. So could you go ahead and give it to our listeners?
Certainly. The easiest way to see what I have to say about sundry issues, from contemporary affairs to the popular music I like, is to go first to our web portal, which is The Right Source Online. And the way to get there is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's all one word, rightsourceonline.com. And from there, you would scroll down the page, and if you look at the left-hand margin of the screen, about a third of the way down the page, you'll find a photograph of myself, and there are a couple of hot links below my photograph, and if you click on the right one, it'll take you to the Pro Libertate blog, which is updated more or less 4 or 5 times a week, sometimes 6. I actually posted 2 items yesterday, and I didn't post anything today because I was working on a different project today. But the Pro Libertate blog is where you'll get almost daily a fully conceived and hyperlink-sourced op-ed piece. Often I will enhance it with YouTube videos or other things that I find that are of interest, and that's one of the glorious things about multimedia publishing as opposed to the two-dimensional publishing on cellulose, is that you can actually enhance it with such wonderful embellishments as audio and video. Not that I denigrate print, which I still think is a wonderful and very relevant medium, but the Pro Libertate blog can be accessed through rightsourceonline.com.
All right, fine. So that's rightsourceonline.com. Well, you've got about a minute to wrap up tonight's program.
I do think it's terrifying that the dominant party right now is committed to the idea of a preemptive nuclear strike on Iran, and if that happens, of course, we are going to unleash something that has never been seen in the world before, which would be essentially a unified front against the United States of America as a rogue country, not merely as a rogue government, but as a rogue country. And that's the sort of thing that makes me think that when people like Mike Huckabee start talking about honor, we'd not only start better counting our spoons, we better start reining these guys in before we end up catching the full brunt of the gale force whirlwind these people have been sowing for us.
In fact, I often think of that phrase, the angel who rides at the whirlwind that directs his storm. George Bush used that phrase twice in his first inaugural address on the 20th of January, 2001. Who is the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm? I agree with you totally. We will become the pariah of the world, and we will have no friends. And will we deserve them? Good night, William. Thank you so very much.
God bless.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I got so involved with my conversation with William, I forgot to get his website out. It's rightsource.com. That's rightsource.com, R-I-G-H-T, and then, of course, you get to the website. You go off to the left side, and you scale down the paper, and you look under Pro Libertate. There's a picture of William, and of course, he has a great blog site there. Go to his blog site, pull down his information. We are privileged to have William come here, and as we are with so many of our speakers who are on a regular basis with Lady Liberty, keeping you abreast of what's really going on in America today. Well, this is the time I certainly want to mention that we are certainly going to be having our all-day conference. It's going to be the 28th of October. That is a all-day Sunday. And we do hope that many of you out there will be able to come the 28th of October, and it will be held at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. If you're interested in getting hotel reservations, they're only available, you know, at the special reduced rate until the end of September. You're going to have to get the reservation in before the 28th of October. So if you're going to come, why give us a call, 1-800-544-8927, if you're going to come from across the country. And otherwise, of course, we'd love to hear from you. We want to know how many people are going to be there, because we're going to be serving lunch. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will want to get the items we mentioned during this last hour, our four-tape set on globalism, the secret threat, the impending police state, the North American community, the demise of national sovereignty, and so many other tape sets. You can find them at our website at radioliberty.com. We hope you're making your preparations for the difficult times that lie ahead. If you've been watching the price of gold, it's like the canary in the mine shaft. It's telling you what's going to happen. It's gone up over $20 an ounce in this last week. Somebody knows that we're on the edge of something very serious. If you do not yet have your DVD on sheltering in place, how you can protect your home in case of a chemical, biological, or nuclear strike on America, the booklet published originally by the Army, but very well done, Nuclear War Survival Skills. And of course, you can get a little kit to build your own nuclear radiation meter, the booklet Making the Best of Basics. And if you haven't, of course, got your food and emergency food supplies in, you'd like to get a free catalog, don't put off doing what needs to be done. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And do you understand what's going on from a logical point of view? There is no logic. If you understand that there are powerful spiritual forces that are energizing the people in positions of control, then it all begins to make sense. My book, Brotherhood of Darkness, my talk, The Forbidden Secret, the DVDs by our good friend Chris Pinto, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, which will give you the whole background of what's going on from a spiritual point of view, Chris's DVD, award-winning, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, Riddles in Stone, and the talk that Chris gave when he was here for our last seminar, The Atlantis Connection. Because you see, there have been people for hundreds of years who believed that America was the lost Atlantis. You know, this was to be the new Atlantis, and we were going to lead the whole world into the new world order, the new world religion. And that is why we are fighting over in Iraq, and that is why we're going to war with Iran and with the rest of the Muslim world. 1.25 billion people. We will stand alone because nobody will stand with us. And of course, we won't be able to afford it financially, because we're a bankrupt nation. We're bankrupt financially, having to borrow $2 to $3.5 billion a day just to pay our debts. But even more than that, we are no longer a Christian nation. We're a bankrupt moral nation, bankrupt morally. So please understand we're involved in a spiritual battle. Pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty. Pray for our provision and protection. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.